This is a Power Broadcast program. More information at powerbroadcast.com.
April 25th, 1953. It's one of those dates that just completely reorganizes how we see the world. It's the moment the blueprint of life itself was finally revealed.
It is. On that day, the journal Nature published three papers, three short papers that described the structure of DNA.
And of course, everyone knows the names from that first paper, James Watson and Francis Crick. Their names are basically legend.
They are, but if we stop there, we're missing the whole story. I mean, the real story. We miss the accidental breakthroughs, the incredible personality clashes, and just the sheer back-breaking work that gave them the data they needed.
And that's the mission for this deep dive for you today.
Oh, yeah.
We are going way beyond the textbook story of, you know, two geniuses in a lab. We're going right onto the floor of the lab at King's College London. We have to, because that famous Watson and Crick paper, it contained, and you really have to grasp this, not one single iota of their own experimental data.
Not a bit. Their beautiful model, their incredible deduction, it relied entirely on X-ray pictures taken by the King's team. And we have amazing access to the memories of the people who were actually there, particularly a PhD student named Raymond Gosling. He was the one operating the machine, the one who actually took the most famous X-ray image in history.
Photo 51.
Photo 51. So we're going to unpack all of it. The toxic management that fueled the whole thing, the pure chance that gave them the perfect sample, and the really painful question of who contributed what and, you know, why history forgets certain names.
The outcome we all know is that Watson and Crick paper. It has that classic, almost comically dry understatement in it. It says, the specific pairing we have postulated immediately suggests a possible copying mechanism for the genetic material.
Mm-hmm. That one sentence is the seed of their fame. It's the beginning of modern biology.
Yeah.
But we're going to look at the roots, because the experimental seeds, they were planted and very nearly destroyed at King's.
Okay, so to get this, to really understand the lab, we have to start at the top with Professor John Randall. He's described in our sources as a true unsung hero, not for his science, but for just creating the place itself.
Yeah, his vision is profound. He was a top-tier physicist, but he was really ahead of the curve. After the war, he saw that the next big thing wasn't just smashing atoms. It was understanding life.
So he starts the Medical Research Council Biophysics Unit at King's.
He does. And you have to understand why that was such a big deal for a physicist to do.
It wasn't the obvious move.
Not at all. For decades, the consensus was that life was so complex, so varied, that the genetic instructions had to be carried by a complex molecule, and that meant protein.
Right. DNA was seen as too simple, too boring.
Exactly. Just a repetitive, dumb little molecule. Randall, by focusing on biophysics, the physical structure of these molecules, was basically rejecting decades of scientific bias. He knew the answer was in the shape of the thing, and X-ray crystallography was the only way to see it.
And what about his leadership style? Our sources are pretty clear on this.
Oh, they are. Autocratic is one word. Another is that he had a Napoleonic complex.
He ran the place like a circus?
He did. But it was a high-energy, high-pressure circus. And crucially, it was dynamic. He smashed together physics, chemistry, biology, and he hired brilliant people. At a time when women were often shut out of top science jobs, Randall actively recruited them. He didn't care who you were, just if you were good.
Okay, so within the circus, we have Maurice Wilkins. He's central to the whole story. Another physicist who made the jump to biology.
Yes, but he was carrying a very heavy burden.
The Manhattan Project.
The Manhattan Project. He'd worked on the atomic bomb. And our sources are very clear that he was, quote, racked with feelings of guilt over it. So he moved to biology, the science of life, almost as a form of penance.
And how did that guilt affect him?
It made him very shy. He was terrible with direct confrontation. He was kind of calculating in how he spoke, very careful. And that, as we'll see, becomes a huge factor later on.
So it's Wilkins and his student, Raymond Gosling, who start the work. And their first attempt is famously a bit strange.
Ram sperm. Well, it was Randall's idea, actually. He had this theory that to get a good X-ray picture, you needed the long DNA molecules to be perfectly lined up. He figured ram sperm have these very flat heads, so maybe the DNA inside would all lie in one plane.
And did it work?
Complete garbage. The pictures were useless. The material just wasn't pure enough. Which brings us to the real problem.
It wasn't about alignment. It was the quality of the DNA itself.
Exactly. And this is where another unsung hero comes in. A Swiss biochemist named Rudolf Steiner.
What did he do that was so special?
The DNA everyone was using at the time was junk. It was degraded, full of protein, which just makes a mess of an X-ray picture. Sinner in Switzerland had figured out a way to gently extract DNA from calf thymus, producing these beautiful, long, intact strands. Super high quality, super pure. Nobody else had it.
And the story of how Wilkins gets his hands on this stuff is just incredible. It tells you everything about the scientific mindset at the time.
It really does. So Sinner gives a lecture at the Royal Society in London, you know, the absolute heart of British science. At the end, he pulls out a little tube of this freeze-dried pure DNA.
And he just offers it up?
He just offers it to the room, says anyone who wants to try X-ray work on it is welcome to some. And in this entire lecture hall full of the top scientists in the country, only two people put their hands up.
Two? That's unbelievable.
Isn't it? As Gosling later said, Wilkins was awake enough to put his hand up. It just shows you, even in 1950, the idea that DNA was the secret of life was still a fringe idea. Everyone else was still obsessed with proteins.
So now Gosling has the good stuff, the pure Sinner DNA. He can finally start pulling fibers from it to get the molecules aligned.
But the technical problems were just immense. I mean, the lab itself was grim. The X-ray machine was in this terrifying lead-lined basement, three floors underground, right next to the River Thames. It was damp. It was cold.
And that damp air was actually part of the problem, right? The air inside the camera itself was scattering the X-rays and fogging the film.
Mm-hmm. So to fix that, they told Gosling to flush the camera out with hydrogen gas. It's much less dense than air, so it doesn't scatter the X-rays.
Okay, but hydrogen is also famously explosive.
Right. The last thing you want is a little Hindenburg disaster in your basement lab. So to control the flow, to see how fast the gas was moving, Gosling had to bubble it through a jar of water first.
A simple, practical solution.
A simple solution that changed everything. That little act of bubbling the hydrogen through water introduced water vapor into the camera.
Oh, wow.
And it created the perfect environment, exactly 92% humidity. And at that precise level of hydration, the brittle, disordered DNA suddenly sucked up the water and it formed microcrystals.
An accident. A complete accident.
A total accident. Gosling left the exposure running for over 90 hours. When he finally developed the film, he knew. He described it as the most exciting thing that's happened to me before or since.
I can't even imagine.
He realized he was the first person ever to make genes crystallize, to see the stuff of life itself form a regular, repeating pattern.
And he runs upstairs to show Wilkins. What was his reaction?
The normally shy, reserved Wilkins was so blown away by the sharp, spotted pictures that he just started drinking his sherry by the gulpful. It was this pure moment of discovery. They knew they had it. They knew DNA had a structure that could be solved.
And we have to mention one last piece of unorthodox lab equipment that Gosling talks about.
The condoms.
The condoms.
Yes. To keep that crucial hydrogen atmosphere sealed inside the camera, Gosling needed a flexible seal for the collimator tube. And to his shock, the intensely shy Maurice Wilkins just hands him a packet of Durex and suggests he use those.
That's amazing.
And Gosling says it was absolutely essential to getting the photos to work. Just a great reminder that, you know, sometimes science requires some very strange solutions.
So those false crystalline photos proved they were on the right track. But it also showed Randall that, well, his team was running more on luck than on rigorous expertise.
Right. They had the data, but neither Wilkins nor Gosling were expert crystallographers. They didn't have the deep theoretical knowledge to solve the structure from the patterns. And that's why Randall recruited Rosalind Franklin.
She was already a distinguished scientist. Her PhD work was on the structure of coal, of all things.
It sounds odd, but it was all about X-ray crystallography. She was an absolute expert in the technique, in the math. She was exactly what they needed to take the work to the next level.
But her arrival is what kicks off this disastrous conflict in the lab.
It's a textbook case of terrible management. It's almost tragic. Randall wrote a letter to Franklin before she arrived, stating very clearly that she would be directing the X-ray work on the Sinner DNA, and that Gosling would be assigned to her as her student.
And Wilkins?
Wilkins was away on holiday. He was never shown the letter. He was never told.
So Franklin walks in the door thinking she's the project lead.
And Wilkins thinks she's just a new hire who's there to assist him with his project. The stage was set for a total disaster.
And Gosling believes this was intentional on Randall's part.
He was convinced of it. He called it a deliberate act of divide and rule. Randall thought that if he created this intense competition, this friction, it would produce results faster.
And it just backfired completely.
Horribly. Wilkins treated her like a subordinate, which as Gosling put it, immediately got her back up. She had been promised by the head of the department that this was her research.
And their personalities just made everything worse.
Oh, they were polar opposites. Franklin was concise, direct, impatient. Some people saw it as an air of cool superiority. She wanted to talk about the data right now, in detail.
And Wilkins was the opposite.
Yeah.
Shy, hated confrontation, preferred to communicate indirectly.
It was oil and water, a pure personality clash. And poor Gosling, as her PhD student, was stuck right in the middle trying to be a peacemaker. He said it was just terrible, terrible.
But despite that toxic atmosphere, Franklin's scientific contribution was immediate, and it was revolutionary.
Absolutely. She came in and completely refined the equipment. And her most critical innovation was building a new camera that could precisely control the humidity using different salt solutions. No more guesswork with bubbling water.
And that precision led directly to the key discovery.
Instantly. It led to the discovery that DNA actually exists in two completely different forms, depending on how wet it is.
Okay, let's break those down for the listener. First, the wet form, or B form.
Right. The B form appears at high humidity, above 75%. It's long and thin, and it's the form that actually exists in our cells. And crucially, it's the B form that produces that beautiful, clear X pattern in photo 51.
And the second form was the tristalline, or A form.
The A form. This appears when the DNA is drier, it's shorter and fatter, and it produces a much more complex, sharp, crystalline pattern with lots of distinct spots.
So Franklin made a strategic choice.
A very methodical one. She and Gosling decided to solve the A form structure first, because even though it looked more complicated, a crystalline pattern is actually easier to analyze mathematically. The plan was solve A, then use that knowledge to tackle the harder B form.
And the result of all this work was photo 51, taken by Gosling under her direct supervision in May 1952. What did that image tell them instantly?
The cross. That big black X dominating the image. In crystallography, that X pattern is the undeniable signature of a helix.
So the debate was over. It had to be a spiral.
It had to be a helix, and you could even measure the angle of the arms of the cross to figure out the pitch of the helix. It was, without a doubt, the best picture of DNA in the world.
But Franklin deduced something else from her data, something that would prove to be absolutely vital in disproving Cambridge's first failed model.
Yes. This was a brilliant piece of chemical and physical reasoning. Based on the pattern and how the DNA crystals behaved in water, she figured out that the phosphate backbone, the part of the molecule with a strong negative charge that loves water, it had to be on the outside of the structure.
Why was that so important?
Think about it. If you bury all those negatively charged phosphate groups in the middle of a molecule, they're going to repel each other like crazy. The whole structure would be incredibly unstable. The fact that DNA could exist in water proved the phosphates had to be on the surface where they could interact with the water and be stabilized by positive ions.
She knew the basic floor plan.
She knew the architecture. She wrote right in her notebook, evidence for spiral structure. Straight chain, untwisted, is highly improbable. She had the fundamentals locked down.
Okay, so let's shift our focus back to Cambridge. James Watson is there, officially studying something else, but he's obsessed with DNA.
Completely obsessed. And his obsession is ignited when he goes to a conference in Naples where Maurice Wilkins is presenting.
And Wilkins shows one of the King's X-ray pictures. Not photo 51 yet, but an earlier, very clear, crystalline one.
Right. And Watson had this reputation for, you know, just reading the newspaper during boring talks. But the second Wilkins put that photo up on the screen, Watson dropped his paper.
He knew.
He knew instantly. It was the proof. If this molecule could be made to crystallize, it meant it had a regular structure. And if it had a regular structure, it could be solved.
And that moment is what prompts him and Crick to build their first model, their first very wrong model.
Very wrong. In November 1951, they rushed to build a triple helix. And the information they're using comes partly from a lecture Franklin had given at King's, which Watson attended.
And what was their fatal mistake?
The same mistake Franklin already knew was impossible. They put the phosphate backbone on the inside.
So they invite the King's team up to see it, including Franklin. And she doesn't pull any punches.
Not a single one. She knew immediately it was chemically impossible. Gosling said she tore the model apart point by point, and she did it with obvious relish. Yeah. Crick later said it was the only time he ever saw Watson completely speechless. Gosling's impression was that Watson felt totally humiliated.
And this failure had serious repercussions.
Oh, yeah. Randall was furious. He went to Cambridge and complained directly to their boss, Sir Lawrence Bragg. And Bragg officially forbade Watson and Crick from working on DNA anymore.
So the race was seemingly over. The lead was handed back to Kings.
It seemed that way. Franklin and Gosling were actually relieved. They were happy to just get back to their lab and quietly, you know, get on with doing the mathematics. But that ban, it didn't really stick.
Right, because for Cambridge to succeed, they needed the King's data. And they got it through two back channels, completely without Franklin's permission.
The first channel was visual. In January 1953, Wilkins, in a moment of frustration with Franklin, showed photo 51 to Watson.
The B-form picture. The helix?
The helix. Watson saw that X pattern and he instantly knew. He saw the symmetry, he understood the pitch. It was the smoking gun.
And the second channel was even more important for the theoretical work, for Crick.
Yes. They got their hands on an unpublished internal report from the Medical Research Council, a report that contained all of Franklin and Gosling's key calculations and parameters from their X-ray analysis.
Including the symmetry of the molecule, the space group.
And that was the absolute key. Gosling and his colleague Alex Stokes had done the hard work of indexing the pattern. They'd figured out the size of the repeating crystal unit and, crucially, that its symmetry belonged to something called the C2 space group.
Let's pause on that because this is where Crick's genius comes in. What did C2 mean and why was it so significant?
C2 is a very specific type of symmetry. It implies that there's a two-fold rotational symmetry. Basically, if you turn the molecule 180 degrees, it looks exactly the same.
So it has to be built in two identical but opposing parts.
Exactly. It points directly to a two-chain structure, a double structure. Gosling had the data. He just didn't fully grasp that final implication. But Crick did.
Why? What was the connection he made?
Serendipity. Pure serendipity. Crick was also working on the structure of hemoglobin, and by sheer coincidence, hemoglobin has the exact same C2 space group.
Wow.
So because he'd been wrestling with the mathematics of hemoglobin, the moment he saw C2 on the King's report, a light bulb went off. Yeah. He knew immediately from their numbers that it had to be a double helix with the two strands running opposite directions. Anti-parallel.
An incredible deductive leap based entirely on their experimental data.
Entirely. So Crick has the physical structure. Watson then supplies the final chemical piece of the puzzle.
Chargaff's ratio.
Chargaff's ratios. The rule that the amount of A always equals T and C always equals G. This was known. It had been published years before. But as Gosling said, no one had made the connection.
Until Watson. He realized it meant A must pair with T and C must pair with G. That's the copying mechanism.
That's the whole secret. The geometry from King's data gave them the helix. Crick's insight on the symmetry gave them the double anti-parallel structure, and Watson's insight on the ratios gave them the base pairing. They had it. The model was finished on February 28, 1953.
It's just an amazing convergence. But let's go back to Franklin for a second, because recent historical work has shown she was much, much closer to solving it herself than the old story suggests.
This is such an important correction to the record. She wasn't stuck. By January 1953, she had been meticulously working through her own data, and she had reconciled the A and B forms. She had concluded in her own notes that both forms were double helices.
Two helices, so she was there.
She was there, and by March 17th, that's the day before she even heard about the Cambridge model, she had already written a draft manuscript that basically described the correct structure.
What did she have?
She had the two strands, the phosphate backbone on the outside, and she had this profound insight. She wrote that the structure would allow for, quote, an infinite variety of nucleotide sequences to explain the biological specificity of DNA.
That's it. That's genetics. The idea that the sequence of the letters is the code.
She got it. She understood the core concept. The only pieces she was missing were the specific AT-CG base pairing and the anti-parallel nature of the strands. If she had just spent a little more time thinking about Chargaff's chemistry instead of her own rigorous math, she might have published first.
So the race wasn't really won by a mile, it was won by a few weeks.
It was a photo finish. It just shows that sometimes building a model based on someone else's constraints can get you there just a little bit faster than proving it step by step from scratch.
So when the King's team finally goes up to Cambridge to see the completed model, what was the reaction? Was it anger? Resentment.
It was immediate recognition, which really speaks to their integrity as scientists. Both Gosling and Franklin saw the model and knew instantly that it had to be right. It was, as Gosling said, so elegant.
And it suddenly made all of their own data make sense.
Completely. Gosling said that his old X-ray analysis patterns, the ones he'd struggled with for years, now just screamed at you, double helix. Once he saw the model, he could see it reflected in his own data.
The elegance was in how it solved the phosphate problem.
Exactly. With the phosphates on the outside, they could be stabilized by sodium ions and water. It explained everything they had measured. It just fit perfectly.
And Franklin's reaction, despite everything, was incredibly gracious.
She showed amazing character. She famously said, "We all stand on each other's shoulders." She absolutely put the science first. Now, at that point, she didn't know the full extent of how her data had been used, but her initial reaction was pure scientist.
So April 25, 1953, the three papers come out in Nature. Watson and Crick's is first, with just that little footnote acknowledging the King's team's unpublished contribution.
And then Franklin and Gosling's paper and the Wilkins paper were published right after. The way it was sequenced made it look like the King's work was just confirmation of the Cambridge model, not the foundation it was built on.
What's so strange, though, is that this earth-shattering discovery lands with a bit of a thud.
It's truly bizarre, isn't it? The initial reaction was almost non-existent. Gosling remembers his colleagues at King's basically saying, "All right, so a double helix? So what?" And just moving on.
Why? Why weren't people freaking out?
It goes back to that old bias. Most of the establishment still thought the genetic material had to be protein. The structure of DNA was interesting, sure, but it wasn't revolutionary until it was proven, experimentally, that this structure was how life actually replicated. And that proof didn't come until years later.
And maybe that muted reaction is why Franklin was ready to move on. She left King's for Birkbeck College.
She was. She famously described the move as going from a palace to the slums, but pleasanter all the same. She just wanted out of that toxic environment, and she absolutely thrived at Birkbeck.
She completely changed her field of study.
She did. She pivoted to studying the structure of viruses. She did groundbreaking work on the tobacco mosaic virus and later the poliovirus. It was essential, Nobel-worthy research. Her colleague, who continued the work, Aaron Klug, won the Nobel for it in 1982.
So the DNA story really only became this massive public legend much later.
Much later. The thing that really lit the fuse was James Watson's book, The Double Helix, which came out in 1968.
And that book is brilliant, but it's also incredibly controversial.
Deeply controversial. It contains what can only be described as a character assassination of Rosalind Franklin. He portrays her as this difficult, uncooperative, frumpy figure, which her friends and colleagues said was completely inaccurate.
And the worst part is she couldn't defend herself.
She had died of ovarian cancer in 1958, 10 years before the book came out.
Now, what did Gosling think of the book?
He felt that Watson was so focused on criticizing Franklin that he just forgot to credit the rest of the King's team at all. Randall, Stokes, Wilkins himself. The book is a fantastic drama, but it's a very biased piece of history.
Which brings us to the 1962 Nobel Prize. Watson, Crick, and Wilkins. But no Franklin.
It's painful. The Nobel rules at the time said the prize couldn't be awarded posthumously. She died in 1958, 4 years before the prize was given, so she was legally ineligible, no matter how crucial her contribution was.
And what about Raymond Gosling? After all this, he left the field of fundamental biology entirely.
He did. He wanted to get closer to his original dream, which was medicine. So he became a medical physicist, studying atherosclerosis, the hardening of the arteries.
And he found a whole new career there.
A very successful and satisfying one. He was trying to figure out why plaques form in arteries where blood moves fastest, which seems a bit counterintuitive.
And even there, he couldn't escape John Randall.
No, Randall had a habit of just appearing silently in people's labs. Gosling was using glass tubes to model blood flow, and Randall just shows up one day and tells him it's useless, that he has to use animal models. He even figured out that cockerels were the best model for human arteries.
And that work led to Gosling's own big discovery.
It did. He developed ultrasound devices to look at arteries, and he found something amazing. He found that before arteries harden, they first become 3 times more flexible. It's like an early warning sign. The artery is stretching and overcompensating before it finally fails.
And that was more satisfying for him.
He said it was. Seeing that direct diagnostic impact on patients' lives was more rewarding to him than the abstract beauty of the double helix.
So when you step back and look at the whole story, it's just this incredible mix of methodical lab work and brilliant deduction.
It really is. You have Sanger's pure sample, Gosling's accidental crystals, Franklin's rigorous analysis of the A and D forms, that's the foundation, and then you have Watson and Crick making that final deductive leap, connecting all the dots.
Yeah, we had to keep correcting the record. It wasn't a race that Cambridge won by a landslide. It was a joint effort. Whether they admitted it or not, Franklin was an equal contributor whose data made the whole thing possible.
Absolutely. And you can't forget the man who started it all, for better or worse, John Randall. The autocratic ringmaster who assembled the team and engineered the very conflicts that, in a strange way, forced the discovery out into the world.
And thinking about that history, the competition, the shortcuts, the personality clashes, it brings us to a really critical point about what this discovery means now. Gosling himself had a final thought on this.
He did. He said he believes humanity is now at a critical stage. Because for all of history, evolution was just something that happened. But now, he said, our species is the first one ever to have their hands on the levers controlling evolution.
That is a huge thought. The knowledge that started in a damp basement with some sherry and some condoms is now the basis for gene editing, for CRISPR. As we start to pull those levers ourselves to edit the very structure they discovered, should we be optimistic? Or does the messy human competitive history of how we got this knowledge cast a bit of a shadow, a warning maybe about whether we're ready to control our own destiny? What stands out to you?